Unitarian Universalism is sometimes called the living tradition. We're open to growing and changing and evolving as new evidence, insights, and experiences come to light. Indeed, if we had our gray hymnals out instead of these teal hymnals, they are actually called Singing the Living Tradition. A more formal way of describing our progressive nature, our innovative orientation, is that we are a theologically liberal religious tradition. In contrast, a theologically conservative religious tradition would tend to resist changing, growing, and evolving, even based on new facts. You've seen that particularly since the 19th century in resistance of many religions to Darwin's theory of evolution, which our Unitarian and Universalist forebears were among the first to embrace. Conservatives tend to preserve traditions, to want to keep current social structures, and to keep long-standing community ties that could be put at risk if innovation comes too much, too fast, too rapidly, as liberals often want. We want change, and we want it now. As religious liberals, we are heirs to two heretical religious traditions, the Unitarians and the Universalists. You heard this morning about one of our UU heirs, Susan B. Anthony, who was, you know, almost 50 years ahead of her time, you know, ahead of the actual enfranchisement of women in this country. She was out getting arrested and pushing boundaries and taking bold risks to make change. And people were saying, what'll happen if we give women the right to vote? And she says, I'm willing to take that risk, right? Probably some really good things will happen that might overturn some traditions that need to be changed. Our ancestors boldly questioned religious traditions as well that had come to seem obsolete or contrary to human reason or human experience. You know, they weren't worried about what the Bible said about women staying silent in church or what Paul might have allegedly said about same-sex relationships. They were like, we know in our experience and in our reason that those things are fine. But we UUs are also a big tent. We seek to be inclusive, to draw as wide a circle as possible in who we include in our congregations. And we're clear that we are welcoming to a wide diversity of religious liberals. If you're a UU Buddhist or a UU Christian or a UU atheist, a UU humanist, a UU pagan, and more, you are welcome here. We're clear about that. But that being said, on this Sunday, 2 days before Election Day, I'd like to invite us to reflect on the ways that despite our wide theological diversity, we're not always as welcoming as we could be or as we should be to a wide diversity of political views. Said differently, can you be a religious liberal and a political conservative? Said more provocatively, can you be a Unitarian Universalist and a Republican? I chose not to make that latter thing my sermon title, but that's actually what I mean. As you heard during the spoken meditation, our lack of intentionality around such questions has resulted in longtime loyal members of UU congregations across this country leaving because they felt alienated, because they felt it was presumed that because they were a member of a UU congregation that they had political views that they did not, in fact, actually hold, even though they were theologically liberal. However, it has not always been the case that theological liberalism, the questioning of traditional religious dogmas, was seen to necessitate political liberalism. Consider these words from our UU historian Mark Morrison Reed. All his books are worth reading. They're really excellent. He writes that during the first half of the 20th century, and what that means importantly, what he means is before McCarthyism, so during the first half of the 20th century, Unitarianism included outspoken socialists like John Haynes Holmes, who was a leader of one of our largest congregations in New York, and included John Haynes Holmes, a socialist on one hand, as well as a strong contingent of conservatives like President and eventual Supreme Court Justice William Howard Taft, who was also president of the Unitarian General Conference in between those two things, as well as Senator Leverett Stallenstall. On the Universalist side, Clarence Skinner represented, so Skinner House Press is the subsidiary of Beacon Press, some of you may know that, that publishes all the UU imprints. Clarence Skinner, after whom that was named, represented the progressive wing of Universalism, while several congressional representatives who attended Universalist National Memorial Church, which is still in D.C., many of them were Dixiecrats, but religious liberals. So as early as the first half of the 20th century, it was commonly possible to be a religious liberal and a political conservative. What changed was the 1960s and the 1970s. Morrison Reed writes that civil rights was the first in a set of issues that grew to include Vietnam War resistance, black power, women's liberation, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights, environmental concerns, and most recently, immigration reform. These movements have reshaped and have polarized the American political landscape in a way that was not true before that. Now, I should pause at this point and clarify that by no means am I suggesting that we should deny or abdicate our tendency and our heritage as Unitarian Universalists to stand on the side of love for social, economic, and environmental justice. Rather, we should be proud and emboldened by the work for peace and justice that our UU ancestors, like Susan B. Anthony and so many others, including today, represent. Indeed, the current UUA Common Read, a book selected annually for all UUs to read and discuss and act on for this year, it is Paul Raiser's 2012 book, Reclaiming Prophetic Witness, Liberal Religion in the Public Square. That book laments the ways that too often all of religion has been stereotyped as conservative theological religion, and says, no, there's also liberal religion, and this is what that looks like in the public square. Raiser's book outlines how our liberal theological heritage can empower and ground our work for peace and justice in a way that we have often been too tentative or just haven't claimed for whatever confluence of reasons. If you're interested, I encourage you to read that book, Reclaiming Prophetic Witness, Liberal Religion in the Public Square. It's only about 100 pages, so I'm not asking too much. Nor is the UUA in selecting this common read. And I'll plan to schedule both a sermon and a congregational conversation about that in early 2015. So you've got a little time to read. At the same time, I want to take seriously that historically, the theologically liberal traditions of Universalism and Unitarianism and now Unitarian Universalism have included figures that were both politically liberal and politically conservative. I also want to take seriously the reflections you heard earlier from the General Assembly workshop that our big tent of Unitarian Universalism is large enough to bridge the partisan divide that has grown increasingly wide since the 1960s. In so doing, we may find that we're able to build relationships of mutual trust and respect with the actual complex human beings on the other side of those masks that are all too simple of Democrat and Republican. To better understand the roots of the partisanship that began to grow deeper in this country in the late 1960s, I'd like to turn back the clock even farther to a time of immense and much greater social change even than the 1960s, which is the late 18th century, the time of the American Revolution and the time of the French Revolution, the two movements that really birthed what we think of today as the left and the right. As our guide, I'd like to look at a fascinating new book that I also recommend to you by Yuval Levin, The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of the Left and Right. Now, I started reading Paine and Burke and modern figures like John Rawls in college when I was a philosophy major, and I took a class called Liberalism and Conservatism. And it's really worth reading those primary sources, but I was really excited to see Levin's book, which just came out this year, come out because it is a one-volume, very accessible introduction to Burke and to Paine and to why they still matter today and deeply influence foundationally these movements. So if you don't have time to go back and read the primary sources, Levin's book is a great introduction. For those with a good memory, I also invite you to keep in mind everything I said 2 years ago in a similar election sermon. I'll post the link to the sermon so you can refresh your memory. It was based on a book by a guy named Jonathan Haidt, not H-A-T-E, HAIDT, a book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. A really excellent book to consider as well that really illuminates a lot of the partisanship that is going on and points us to the way that we might come to a place of greater mutual trust and respect. Many have heard me say before that the Latin root of the word liberalism is liber, which means free. And it gives us a range of words from liberal to libertarian, a range of connotations, positive connotations like the Statue of Liberty, Liberty, which welcomes all immigrants to our shores, but also negative connotations like libertine, one who is irresponsible with freedom. Although liberalism is sometimes seen as a dirty word, that all liberals are libertines, when we talk about Unitarian Universalism, what we mean, and it being a liberal religious tradition, what we mean is liberalism in the best sense of that word. We mean liberal as open to new ideas, generous, open-handed, open-hearted, open-minded. And the liberal turn in religion is precisely that demand of both freedom from and freedom for. Freedom from religious beliefs and authorities whose only justification is tradition. Whose only justification for continuing to believe certain things and to do certain things is we've always done them that way. Allegedly, right? We haven't really, but... And so liberals say that's not sufficient justification to continue believing or doing something. We want freedom from that, but we also want freedom for wherever our reason and wherever our experience shows us would be good for us and our societies. It's what we use call our fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. But what about those individuals and communities whose free search for truth and meaning leads them to vote Republican, or at least for some Republican candidates? What do we do about that? Can we respect their inherent worth and dignity? Can we engage them in dialogue? And what insights might Paine and Burke, those 18th century luminaries, have for us 21st century religious liberals, who may include both political conservatives and liberal political figures, and who want to build a tent big enough to cover the partisan divide? To begin with Thomas Paine, it's most fitting that his most famous publication is a 50-page pamphlet titled Common Sense. Because classic liberalism and the Enlightenment in general is about the turn from history and tradition and allegedly one-time divine revelations in the past to universal truths that are apparent and verifiable in all times and places through human reason and human experience. Another word for such universally human truths and provable truths is common sense. One major target of Thomas Paine's pen was the hereditary British monarchy, which he saw as wholly opposed to common sense. For Paine, if you just took one step back from the British monarchy, from such accepted conventions, it became self-evident that one particular allegedly noble family had come to power through some sort of historically contingent circumstances that were usually manipulative, selfish, Machiavellian, and actually usually quite violent. He saw nothing natural about the alleged divine right of kings. Why, he asked, would you want to give perpetual authority to the heirs of someone who had lied, cheated, and killed their way to power? And even if they had somehow stumbled backwards into legitimate power, why would you think that their heirs, who often eventually become corrupt, were the best leaders, as opposed to saying, who are the best leaders in this generation, not just because of what their genes are? He wouldn't have said genes, right? Anyway. Instead, Paine argues in his 1791 book, The Rights of Man, that all humans are born equal with equal natural right. You can hear echoes of the same liberal Enlightenment views that inspired Thomas Jefferson and other founders of our country to throw off the yoke of the hereditary British monarchy and demand that government be based on the consent of those being governed right then in each generation. To begin to bring Edmund Burke into the equation, it's fascinating to note that he actually agrees with Paine about the corrupt origin of most monarchies. And they even both agree historically about, they also agree about the historically contingent origin and the often corrupt origin of most religions. But Burke cautions that we're often unwise to ask those sorts of questions. So Paine's right, but stop listening to him and stop asking so many pesky questions. For Burke, we should not pull back the curtain and expose that the wonderful Wizard of Oz is actually a mere mortal who is imperfect and finite. For Burke, we need such illusions that are built up over time to keep stability in societies. Moreover, Burke warns that theorists such as Thomas Paine are naive to put so much trust in human reason, that each new generation will be totally reasonable and will make the right votes. Paine was actually for a unicameral, annually elected legislature. So he was not for direct democracy, for representative democracy, but that you should basically be open to rewriting the laws every year, you know, every generation. So Burke said that was foolish to think that people were so reasonable, and that it was foolish in his failure to see that the idea of human rights, too, is historically contingent, as the idea of hereditary monarchy, so that human rights are created by humane societies over time, just as inhumane societies create very terrible human rights violations. So Burke didn't think there's any guarantee that you start to tear down social conventions. He saw no guarantee that good human rights would be put in place. And that for Burke, he was like, it's common sense to me that humans are ruled much more by emotions than by reason. Jonathan Haidt has a powerful metaphor here of the elephant and the rider. He says that the elephant is our emotions, and we humans are like a semi-reasonable director of this elephant of our emotions. And Burke said, you're not paying enough attention to the elephant. And that, so again, we should be careful of undermining societies. So whereas Paine is always in a rush to allow each new generation to tear down the past social, political, religious arrangements and rebuild them based on reason and the needs of the present, Burke is concerned that by tearing down tradition and conventions, one is much more likely to result not in reason, compassion, peace, justice, human rights, but in anarchy, in violence, and in might makes right. Burke is for social progress, but he's for gradual evolution instead of immediate revolution. Keep in mind that Burke and Paine are writing for the world stage in response for the intense upheaval and violence of the French Revolution, in which the king, queen, and other nobility were beheaded by that newfangled invention at that time, the guillotine. The equivalent today would be perhaps if the Occupy Wall Street movement, if instead of setting up tents in Zuccotti Park, if they had set up guillotines to behead the wolves of Wall Street, that would have been what Burke and Paine were talking about, that level of revolution. At the same time, when I hear people in power telling marginalized groups, just be patient, I can't help but hear the words of Dr. King in my ear. In his letter and his challenge in the letter to the Birmingham jail, which was written to white moderates like Edmund Burke. The white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with the goal you seek, I just don't agree with your direct action, who paternalistically believes, and Edmund Burke is nothing if not paternalistic, if you read him, who paternalistically believes that he can set the timetable for another human being's freedom. It's much easier for Burke to say slow down and wait for freedom and equality when he, for the last few decades, has had a comfortable seat in the British House of Commons. Overall, though, my experience of reading Burke and Paine and of reading Levin's book, The Great Debate, is really of feeling a pendulum swinging back before me. They both really have important points, and what they represent, the left and right, really aren't a problem that can be solved once and for all. It really is a tension it's a polarity that has to be managed. It is not a tension, and it is not a problem that can just be simply solved. Because we need prophets like Thomas Paine calling for liberty and equality now, through revolution, if necessary. And we need voices like Burke reminding us that we are not merely a collection of rational people or just of individuals. Human nature is much more complex than reason alone, and we are much more driven by selfishness and by our emotions than we usually admit. There are also important values to be found in history and traditions, and important obligations that we should owe to the common good beyond what is merely in one individual's best interests. And liberals are often best at securing individual rights, but we're not as good about connecting to the common good. And just as we intend Unitarian Universalism to be a liberal religious tradition, in the best sense of that word, liberal, open to new ideas, generous, open-handed, open-hearted, open-minded, there has been room historically and there is room today within liberal religion for those who are conservative in the best sense of the word. Maybe there's not room for those who are conservative in the worst sense of the word, just as sometimes we have trouble with those who are liberal in the worst libertine sense of the word. But there is room for those who are conservative in the best sense of the word, caring about the conservation of nature, upholding the beauty of traditions and rituals that have stood the test of time and have power because they have stood the test of time, reminding us of the importance not only of individual rights and equality, but of community, of authority, of sanctity, of loyalty. This dynamic is one reason why many UUs resonate deeply with contemporary prophets such as Wendell Berry, who is, I will invite you to consider, conservative in the best sense of the word. We desperately need such voices in our movement. We UUs like to say that we are standing on the side of love. And wherever you find yourself on that political spectrum, that polarity between the left and the right, wherever you find yourself this coming election day, as we put into practice our fifth principle of democracy, may you discern within your own conscience what it means for you right here and now to vote on the side of love.